listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Alone, together, small faces on a smudgy screen helped conjure a future, one that holds pleasure and hope, by Kiesi Makeba Lehman, opening photograph by McNair Evans, which shows a bedroom with an open window, sunlight streaming in. Early this morning, my mailman read me a story, two stories, actually. I met my mailman, Sean, in July. While sitting on my porch, Sean had walked up and asked if Biggie Smalls was my favorite MC. Before I could answer, Sean said he noticed the portrait of Biggie in my sunroom. Sean placed my delivery on the steps and asked why I had so many books delivered. I told Sean I was a teacher and writer. Sean told me he'd never taught, but that he was a writer, too. I sat out on that porch, listening to Sean rap 1.5 songs about his old life in Kansas City and recite the synopses of two projects he needed to finish. "I'm not sure if they're screenplays or novels or short stories," he told me. This morning, I listened over speakerphone as Sean read the first 5 handwritten pages of the two stories he started on my porch. I lay on my bed, the back of my head buried deep into a down pillow that 10 minutes earlier I held like a soft someone I hoped would not leave. I never dreamed that my mailman asking me about the most effective use of third-person point of view would be what pleasure on a summer Sunday morning felt like. Like so many of my friends, my past 8 months have been spent dodging death, mourning the dead, creating art, and loving black people. I've lingered in socially distant conversations with strangers. I've cried and laughed at what made me cry and laugh. I've made recipe-less meals that were so nasty, all I could do was giggle in the middle of every bite. I've tenderly touched parts of my body I'd forgotten. I've found that pulling the hairs out of my corona beard is actually soothing. I've reread, rewritten, revised. I've done all of this not simply in the hopes of feeling good, but because I long to feel less like we are going to die tomorrow. I am a black southern writer from Mississippi. That is my superpower. Aloneness is our fuel, loneliness our fire. But this, whatever this is, hurts in a new way. Folks across the political spectrum have talked a lot about normalcy this year, prognosticating when and how we'll get back to it. In response, there have been heaps of brilliant essays, speeches, and webinars about how the obliteration of an inequitable normal is the first step in creating a place where abusers of power are held accountable and the vulnerable actually have equitable access to healthy choices and first, second, and third chances. When this new normal is created or accepted, I wonder what will happen to sentimentality. That gorgeous monster James Baldwin called the ostentatious parading of excessive and spurious emotion the mark of dishonesty in art, artist, and the audiences who give us life. How will we distinguish what feels good from what is supposed to feel good when all of our skies are orange and every stranger's touch is a violation? After not having touched another human for over 3 months, the night before I talked with Sean, I drove to one of the only restaurants in town that still only offers curbside service. I touched the finger of a masked woman who brought Thai fried rice with tofu level 4 to my truck. I tipped her as much as the meal cost and thanked her for committing to curbside. She put the tip in her pocket and thanked me for committing to her restaurant. There's a sentimental version of this story where, exploitation be damned, we both wait until we are out of each other's sight to clean our hands, take off our mask, and nod our heads slowly up and down at the grit, grind, and grandeur of Americans. I did not live that version of the story. The kind woman who accepted my money went directly from my truck to the car next to me. I cried alone in my truck. Later that night, I saw that someone sent me a clip of a brother who goes by the name of Dogface208 gliding on a skateboard from the highway on-ramp with a half-drunk 64-ounce bottle of Ocean Spray Cran Raspberry Juice in one hand and a phone recording himself in the other. 16 seconds into the video, Dogface 208 bends at the waist and sings into the air. I watched the clip a second time with sound, and everything changed. I noticed Dogface 208's familiar nod to us, and really him, is so in the pocket of the song. As Stevie Nicks sings, "Now here we go again, you say you want your freedom." I notice trucks, factories, and two tattooed feathers behind Dogface 208's ear. I see yellow and white lines marking the margins of the highway. I see how baggy and plush his gray sweatshirt is. I notice the familiar way he smacks his lips, relishing the punchy sweetness. I feel, with every ounce of joy in my body, Dogface 208's acceptance of fear and joy when he bends and lip-syncs the lyrics. It's only right that you should feel, that you should play the way you feel it. I'd heard and loved Fleetwood Mac's Dreams thousands of times, but I'd never felt the freedom and loneliness I felt when watching Dogface 208's TikTok. The video didn't make me forget that many of us are dying, dead, or mourning. The clip gave me another portal of entry into pleasure and movement. Dogface 208 bended and really blended my gendered, raced, classed, and placed expectations of revolutionary desire and art. But listen carefully to the sound of your loneliness is the next line of the song We Do Not Hear. 3 mornings later, I am sitting in front of a smudged computer screen. 68 mostly black high school students from Baltimore's City Neighbors High School have invited me into what in 2020 we call a classroom. I am expected to read a chapter from my new book and teach the young people about the multiple uses of point of view in narrative art. I do not want to do what is expected of me, because what is expected of me will not feel good to anyone. I ask the students if they'd rather talk about fear and joy and concrete language. The only rule of the exercise is there are no abstractions allowed. 2 hours later, my computer, our classroom, is closed. I am on my knees wondering why I am energized, satisfied, but not sobbing. 68 young people from Baltimore did what our geriatric presidential candidates and moderator could not do the night before. They used word patterns they'd never used. They talked freshly about fear of isolation. They collectively unraveled how capitalism encourages a speed that makes love, pleasure, and actual contemplation nearly impossible. They wondered why school didn't teach them how to gracefully lose and graciously win. They made critiques of the nation and critiques of themselves. They listened to each other toe the thinnest of lines between yearning for pleasure and aching for escape. They accepted that they are worthy of the most exquisite joy. They argued vigorously about the ethics of seeking pleasure at the expense of essential workers, like many of their parents, who put their lives on the line for a tomorrow filled with remedies to overdue rent, grocery bills, bludgeoning debt. They wondered how to make essential labor into pleasurable labor for essential laborers when the nation insists on treating them as expendable at best and big-hearted collateral damage at worst. Those 68 12th graders made themselves feel good. Then they thanked each other for making themselves feel good, all the while pulverizing my understanding of sentimentality. Later that night, I am sent an essay I read the first time one day after September 11, 2001, called Blood, Bread, and Poetry. "Nothing need be lost," the exquisite Adrienne Rich wrote. "No beauty sacrificed. The heart does not turn to stone." I love Adrienne Rich. I have believed Adrienne Rich my entire reading life. I am not sure I believe this Adrienne Rich passage anymore. Beauty is absolutely sacrificed. Our hearts often do turn to stone. This arduous acceptance is a radical pleasure, a sad but sensuous reminder that we are worthy of looking forward to responsibly feeling good in a world of ruin, where presidents shed their COVID-filled mask, wash their nasty hands of death, and the blood drips from the sky. When the rain washes us clean, we will know. We will feel so good. I believe that. If we find, however, that the rain has actually left more bruises, soaked us in more sour than we ever imagined, and if that bruised sour feels so good, it is then that the pleasurable work actually begins. Many of our hearts are stone. Much of the beauty here has been sacrificed, and most of it stolen. There is no commercial, doctor, or wellness regimen to smudge that truth. Home is gone. But there is responsible pleasure to be found in the wreckage, in the pathways of the wrecked, and in all the goodness beyond where we've been allowed to discover. Everything, finally, is lost.
Thank you.
Elon Musk, totally awful, batshit crazy, completely bonkers, most excellent year. With opening illustration by Peter Horvath, showing Elon Musk, planets swirling around him, also examples of modern design around him. In 2020, the COVID-doubting, media-hating, Twitter-holic CEO became the third richest man alive. SpaceX launched two astronauts into orbit, and Tesla became the most valuable car company on the planet. Nick Bilton gets inside the mind of Silicon Valley's most vainglorious villain. Elon Musk is on a mission. He's on a mission to Mars. He's on a mission to save humanity from its reliance on fossil fuels, which could destroy the planet and kill us all. He's on a mission to save us from artificial intelligence algorithms going rogue and machines ending human life as we know it. He's on a mission to help save a group of boys trapped underground in Thailand, a mission to transport people from Los Angeles to San Francisco in giant air tubes, a mission to build ventilators for hamstrung hospitals during the coronavirus pandemic. He's on a mission to prove the coronavirus fatality rate is greatly overstated, to dig tunnels underground to alleviate the fatuous cycle of traffic jams, to save journalism, to mitigate the effects of climate change, to transport people in earthbound rockets from one continent to the next in mere minutes, to inhabit other planets before the sun explodes and turns our oceans into boiling vats of water, our skies into steam-filled death, our lands into carbon crust of darkness. He's on a mission to inhabit other star systems. All of these missions are completely possible in the realm of physics and science. Especially with Elon Musk's brain working to solve these problems. But this year, Musk set off on the most difficult mission of all, an expedition that has nothing to do with space, or fossil fuels, or coronavirus, or saving the lives of 7.7 billion people. And yet, this new mission, unlike the long list of other tasks he plans to accomplish in his lifetime, is one that he may not be able to see through. A mission that, perhaps, no one of his stature has ever been able to accomplish. One that plagued Steve Jobs before he died. One that still afflicts Jack Dorsey each day. A mission that has sickened men and women since the dawn of modern civilization. Kings, queens, business leaders, and politicians alike. A mission that may prove to be the most difficult one of his entire life. Elon Musk is on a mission to stop giving a shit what people think of him. Anyone who has paid even the slightest notice to Musk and his career over the past three decades, a series of vocations that would be almost impossible not to notice, is acutely aware that the 49-year-old entrepreneur, car maker, and rocket scientist is arguably one of the most capable CEOs on the planet, and is not merely changing the world, but the very fabric of the universe. He started the most successful private rocket company in history, and the most successful car company in the world, as well as a controversial solar provider. Lately, he has been building tunnels under Las Vegas to alleviate traffic, and exploring doing the same in Los Angeles, Baltimore, and Chicago, while overseeing Neuralink, a company that wants to eventually plant computer chips in our brains, and recording a rap song that now has millions of listens. When I spoke to more than a dozen people who know him, both personally and professionally, irrelevant of whether they love him or hate him or both, most described Musk as a true genius. One simply said, "I've worked all over Silicon Valley with some of the brightest minds in the world, and there's only one person I would consider a true genius, who is head and shoulders the smartest guy in the room, and that is Elon." In addition to his superhuman abilities, Musk is an excellent father, according to some close to him, and the third richest person on the planet, worth around $108 billion as of October. As a result, he has been on the cover of almost every mainstream magazine in the world, including Wired, Time, The Atlantic, Newsweek, Fortune, Rolling Stone, and even Edibles magazine. Yet over the past year, a man who has done all of this before he has even turned 50 seems pained, like something has been gnawing away at him. At times, he even seems like he's on the edge of madness. An artist moments away from cutting off his own ear and dropping it in a mailbox, or perhaps posting a picture of it on Twitter. To us mere mortals, this seems strange, given that in 2020, the darkest year in modern history, Musk has accomplished more than almost any of us will achieve in our lifetimes. And yet, even as he is making good on his promises to deliver us from ourselves, his mission to do the same for himself is proving to be far more difficult. Every culture and every era in time has its legends. The Chinese praised the great warriors and warlords who controlled the Asian Empire. The Polynesians worshipped the gods who supplied them with fish. In Europe, those who set off to find new lands were knighted and had entire armadas named after them. Yet in the relatively infantile United States of America, folklore and luminescence has bounced from one type of deity or false idol to the next. Politicians, once respected for changing the tides of society by beating back the axis of evil, are now mostly parodies of reality TV. Bankers, once idolized for their wealth, are now vilified and detested by the proletariat. Journalists with last names like Cronkite and Gellhorn have seen their profession bastardized by Hannitys and Ingrams. As of late, the most idolized in America have become the ones who are now partially destroying it, the tech titans. One by one, they've been built up as gods among us, Steve Jobs, Sergey Brin, Marissa Mayer, and Jeff Bezos, to name a few, had virtual statues of them erected in digital squares, which were then systematically spray-painted, dismantled, and tossed over a bridge as their true dualities came to light. This year, it seems, it was Musk's turn. At the forefront of the ire against Musk was his attempt to disprove the severity of the coronavirus at the height of the pandemic by downplaying the number of deaths and railing against America's decision to go into lockdown. This is partially, of course, due to the fact that shelter-in-place orders shuttered Musk's Tesla factory right when it was getting into a production groove. But his puerile approach to disagreeing with the response to COVID-19 and his disregard and denigration of true experts aligned him with Donald Trump and his alt-right supporters, making Musk a pariah to the other half of the country that once revered him. On a Tesla earnings call, Musk stoked the fires, calling the shelter-in-place orders fascist and not democratic. He told the bro-friendly Joe Rogan that the actual mortality rate from coronavirus differed from projections by at least a factor of 10, maybe a factor of 50, a statement that is completely fabricated. But while Musk was playing the coronavirus skeptic in public, things were playing out differently in private. One person confided that Musk told them he was canceling trips to Asia due to COVID concerns. By May, seemingly fed up with Musk antics, the tide seemed to change enough that supporting him was akin to supporting Trump. This was exemplified when former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, tweeted, "It feels good to unfollow at Elon Musk." The turn from Musk, savior of the human race, to what the F is wrong with Elon Musk, a question that is constantly posed to me, began back in 2018, in what people internally at Tesla and SpaceX refer to as the summer of 420, according to two former executives. Musk, at the time, was constantly irked by the fact that Wall Street was shorting Tesla stock by more than $250 million, with more people betting against Tesla, and in turn Musk, than any other company in the United States, according to financial technology and analytics firm S3 Partners, LLC. Over the years, covering Musk and his companies, numerous employees have told me Musk sees the shorting of his stock as especially egregious, given that Tesla is trying to help save the planet by ending our reliance on fossil fuels. As the story now goes, on August 7th of that year, while driving to the airport, Musk tweeted, "I'm considering taking Tesla private at $420, funding secured." Indeed, that turned out to be untrue. The number 420, a weed reference, was chosen as a joke. Less than a month earlier, he had called a cave rescuer in Thailand, Pedoguy, and was becoming increasingly erratic on earnings calls, on social media, and in interviews. By September, he got high and drunk, or at least tipsy, on the Joe Rogan Experience, smoking a joint and drinking whiskey. To everyone watching, it seemed as if Musk was finally unraveling from the pressure of his mission to save the world. The thing about Elon is that right now, everyone else is finally seeing the way he has always been, said a former Tesla executive who worked with Musk for years. He's being the same Elon he has always been in private. Now, this past year, he's just being Elon a lot more publicly. Some people close to him believe his erratic behavior in 2020 was even more on display because he has taken to substances, including alcohol and marijuana, which he obsesses about on social media, or LSD, as the singer Azalea Banks has claimed, and Musk has denied, or Ambien, which the board of Tesla has reportedly worried over. Whatever his drug of choice, several executives have told me that employees at all of his companies check Musk's Twitter account first thing in the morning to see what disaster happened the night before, and to decipher if it will lead to a new lawsuit, affect Tesla's stock price, or add to growing public resentment toward their CEO. We all wake up and look at it every day thinking, "Oh God, now what?" "You really had no idea what you were going to see," one former employee said. At SpaceX and Tesla, another Tesla executive told me, employees from both companies keep one another abreast of Musk moods so that they'll know if Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde is coming into the office that day. On SpaceX launch days, you have everyone at Tesla tuned in to see if the launch is successful, not because we are vested in the rockets, but because it directly impacts Elon's mood for the next few days, the Tesla executive told me. If there was a failure on a launch, there'd be hell to pay. You didn't want to have a phone call set up with Elon afterward. On the other hand, if the rocket launch was successful, Musk's inbox would fill with budget requests. The same is true for SpaceX employees when new production numbers are set to be released for Tesla. In the past, Musk ire outside his companies was usually pointed toward authority, for which he has little patience and disregards as if the world we live in and the rules that govern it don't apply to him and his companies. Musk simply hung up on the National Transportation Safety Board chairman when discussing a fatal Tesla autopilot accident. On earnings calls this year, he has constantly interrupted analysts. After his debacle in the summer of 420, he was charged with fraud by the SEC, but couldn't leave it alone and referred to the agency as the Short Seller Enrichment Commission. Musk eventually settled with the SEC, agreeing to step down as Tesla's chairman and pay $40 million in penalties. By spring of this year, when shelter-in-place orders were issued in Alameda County, where Musk Tesla Fremont plant is located, he refused to send employees home. After finally relenting, he went on a Twitter tirade, threatening to sue the county and even to leave California altogether before he got his way and the plant was reopened. This wayward behavior is on display in his personal life, too. According to one person who witnessed an argument between Musk and a former girlfriend upon leaving a club one evening, Musk aggressively railed against her, asking why she had hair on her face, referring to the slight peach fuzz that everyone has, visible under the bright light of the club's awning. "Because I'm a mammal," the girlfriend replied, which only pissed Musk off even more. "There is a high level of degenerate behavior with Elon," one person who knows Musk told me. "There's a paranoia. Are you with me or against me?" "Musk hyper-energy is sometimes uncomfortable to be around," this person added. "I genuinely want to leave the room sometimes when he walks in." And while he can even come across as a bully, they noted that Musk is not alone among tech titans in this character trait. "All of these guys, I've spent time with them, Musk, Zuck, all of them, they all exhibit tendencies of total and complete pathological sociopathy. They don't at their core give a flying F about you or me as individuals. They do, however, all seem to give a shit what people think of them. Usually, when the tides of praise turn against someone of such stature, they hire consultants, lobbyists, and public relations firms to get them puff pieces in national news outlets. Or they agree to give talks at major tech conferences, as long as the questions are little bitty softballs. Most of these CEOs and tech leaders are so obsessed with their image that they employ armies of communications experts who help craft their brilliance for all to see. Executives I've covered in Silicon Valley almost always have teams prep them for interviews with a long list of all the possible questions they might be asked, and a long list of highly scrutinized answers. Yet, after the summer of 420, Musk has taken on a completely different approach, one that is unlike anyone else at his level, and one that some argue is working out better than he ever could have imagined. The afternoon of December 6, 2019, was one of the most defining moments in Musk's decades-long career, according to several people close to him. It wasn't one of his most daunting missions into space, or yet another impregnable project with electric cars, or brain implants, or underground tunnels. Rather, it was a mission involving, what else? A tweet. Musk had spent the previous year and a half trying to, at times, rewrite the reasoning for his tweet, accusing a British cave explorer who had helped rescue a dozen boys trapped in a Thai cave of being a pedophile. At other times, Musk had tried to justify the tweet's existence. The whole debacle culminated in a lawsuit by the cave explorer, Vernon Unsworth, and that afternoon in 2019, a verdict was due as to whether Musk should pay Unsworth damages, and more importantly to the billionaire, be perceived as being wrong. Musk was surrounded by his personal security guards as he set off to the U.S. District Courthouse in Los Angeles. Most people on the periphery of the case had assumed Musk would surely lose, but his luck, or money, given the price tag of the law firm Musk used to defend his tweet, would have it, he ended up winning. As he walked out of the courthouse, clearly relieved, having completed yet another mission, he told a gaggle of reporters, "My faith in humanity is restored." And then he did something completely out of the ordinary. Musk went to Twitter and started blocking many of the reporters who had covered the trial, or who covered his companies, including Ryan Mack of BuzzFeed, Laura Kolodny of CNBC, and Dana Hull, who covers Tesla and SpaceX for Bloomberg. A move that no other CEO of a Fortune 500 company is known to have made. According to one person who worked with Musk through this whole escapade, he decided shortly after he won the case that he was finished trying to be nice to the journalist, seeing them as biased against him. How very Trump of him. What's more, he decided he was done being nice to anyone else who didn't agree with him. He had spent his entire career trying to pretend he gave a shit about what people thought of him, and he was done. He soon parted ways with a public relations firm he worked with. He didn't fill positions in his communications division when people left. And as this person said, Elon is his own communications director now. When reached for comment on this article, he responded, "Vanity Fair sucks," attributing the quote very clearly to himself. Over the years, Musk has sometimes attacked the credibility of journalists, but as 2020 wore on, he went even further. He started to take on some of Trump's tricks with the media, saying things publicly like The Onion may be the best mainstream media source, and in the same way that Trump soured on CNN and mostly only shared news clips from Fox News, and then soured on Fox News, only sharing clips from even more conservative outlets like One America News Network. Musk almost exclusively tweets links to heavily pro-Tesla websites like Teslarati, which often read more like a press release from Tesla than journalism. And like Trump, Musk loves to throw digital Molotov cocktails on the internet. He went from aiming to be on the cover of magazines to help his business grow to giving the middle finger to every mainstream news outlet who didn't parrot his vision of the world. On Twitter, he seemed to just want to be himself more, too. At times on social media, Musk seems sane and collected, sharing tidbits about science and climate change. At other times, he is erratic and irrational, tweeting things that seem to coddle the alt-right, men's rights activists, and random conspiracy theorists. As his attacks against the conventional wisdom around coronavirus wore on earlier in the year, Musk ignored those who tried to point out how his understanding of COVID-19 was blatantly incorrect, and how deadly the disease really is. The new Elon Musk didn't care. Like a child covering his ears and yelling, la 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 la, he simply didn't want to hear it. While Twitter has proven to be a hotbed of chaos for Musk, during certain times of the year, his habits on the platform played out like a Shakespearean drama. In the first week of June, for example, shortly after he and his girlfriend, the artist and singer Grimes, had their baby, Musk began following his ex-wife, Justine Musk, then followed his other ex-wife, Tallulah Riley. They were married and divorced twice. And bizarrely, a few days later, unfollowed Grimes before refollowing her again hours later. When Grimes later shared a thoughtful 274-character explanation of the name of their first child, XAA12, a translation which includes references to elven spelling, the unknown variable of the letter X, emojis of swords, a metal rat, and the SR-17 aircraft, Musk publicly responded that she had made a mistake and the plane was actually an SR-71. "I'm recovering from surgery and barely alive, so may my typos be forgiven? But damn it," Grimes responded, "that was meant to be profound." Followed, of course, by a hedgehog emoji. Many people I've spoken to who have worked with Musk in the past, or are close to him, have pointed out that, from a financial and corporate perspective, Musk's mission to block his detractors and to not care what others think of him, to be himself, jerk or otherwise, is working better than he or anyone around him could have imagined. This past year, Musk successfully launched 2 astronauts into orbit from the United States, the first in almost a decade. Tesla became the most valuable car company on the planet in July, and Musk is working toward implanting chips into people's brains. Tesla also seemed poised to be inducted into the S&P 500, but a variety of factors, including Musk's stock options, may have impeded it from making the cut. When I started reporting this story earlier this summer, Musk was worth half of what he is today, and while he's disliked by the left, he is still idolized among the technorati. While it appears that Musk mission to say and do whatever he wants without caring about the results has worked out financially, there is another side to the story that those close to him, and especially Musk himself, are acutely aware of. Since around the summer of 420, Musk has lost more than 24 executives at Tesla, including 3 different general counsels, his director of engineering, director of sales, directors of finance, operations, accounting, production, and recruiting. His chief of staff, Sam Teller, who helped advise Musk with all things related to SpaceX, Tesla, and the Boring Company, also left after 5 years at Musk's side. One of those former executives told me there were times Musk would say or tweet something that was just too embarrassing to even try to defend. Which brings us to the great irony of Elon Musk and his endless missions. They all have a duality to them, and Musk seems able to see only one side of the equation. His mission to colonize Mars, for example, is one that he envisions will save humanity, given that we will likely destroy Earth through climate change, or artificial intelligence, or some other cataclysmically awful human-inspired event. According to all the people I spoke to for this article, Musk thinks starting over somewhere else will give us an opportunity to do things better next time. He genuinely believes that he can build enough rockets that we could see 1 million people living on the red planet by 2050. But when we eventually end up on another planet, humanity is most likely to do there what we've done here, destroy whatever wonder we have built. Nowhere is that more on display than with Musk himself. Humans are capable of great things. Every once in a while, a human comes along and propels us forward by leaps and bounds. A human like Musk. But at the same time, those humans are imperfect, even if we don't want them to be. They are flawed. They are not perfect. They are absolute extremes of themselves, explained one of Musk's former executives. If we end up on Mars, Musk will be there too, and he will bring his extremes with him. People will still disagree with each other. They will still argue about the way that world should be. If Twitter works on the red planet, Musk will still be blocking people who don't agree with him. And his own personality defects won't be left here on Earth. Musk, at times, can even acknowledge this himself. One former employee told me that once. This person asked Musk if he ever worried about losing his mind. Musk replied, "Does a crazy person ever look in the mirror and know that he's crazy?" Perhaps this is really the most important mission Musk is on, to never have to answer that question. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Jimmy Kimmel, the late night host on Tube Tops, Trout, and David Letterman's Ties. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Floating in a river full of fat trout. What is your greatest fear? Danger to my children and tidal waves. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Gluttony. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Selfishness. What is your greatest extravagance? My precious moments porcelain figurine collection. What is your favorite journey? The 3 a.m. trip from the bathroom back to bed. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Pride. On what occasion do you lie to avoid hurting feelings? What do you dislike most about your appearance? Being subject to it. Which living person do you most despise? Donald Jessica Trump. What is your greatest regret? Not spending more time with my grandparents. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My wife, Molly, who is the who, and pizza is the what. When and where were you happiest? I'm a happy guy in general, but the feeling of freedom and fun I got driving around with my friends in my first car is hard to top. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd like to hit a 95-mile-per-hour fastball over the center field wall. What is your current state of mind? Grateful and uneasy. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I wish I enjoyed exercise. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I'd put my brother in a tube top. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Figuring out how to make money doing the same things that got me in trouble in high school. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? If there is such a thing as karma, probably a trout with a hook in its lip. What is your most treasured possession? When he retired, David Letterman sent me a large box full of all of his ties. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Hopelessness. What is your favorite occupation? It seems like Judge Judy has a fun job. What is your most marked characteristic? For a person who does nothing but F around, I don't F around. Who are your favorite writers? There are many, of course, but Kurt Vonnegut Jr. always comes to mind. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Ignatius J. Riley. Who are your heroes in real life? The doctors, nurses, and respiratory therapists who saved my son's life. What are your favorite names? Peaches and Herb. What is it that you most dislike? Ignorance. And forced high fives. How would you like to die? Reluctantly. What is your motto? Mottos are for dicks. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Jimmy Kimmel. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.